The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs is one of the most poorly managed departments in the U.S. government, rivaling elements of the Justice Department, like the Bureau of Prisons and the FBI, in documented wrongdoing. Different presidents have appointed secretaries with different backgrounds to try to right the ship, including generals, business executives, attorneys, and even activists, but nothing has worked. There's something deeply wrong about the culture within Veterans Affairs. We only know about it thanks to whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou, and welcome to The Whistleblowers. In 2018, four police officers from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs went public with allegations of waste, fraud, abuse, and illegality in the sprawling department that is supposed to take care of America's veterans. VA police officers are responsible for protecting VA property, staff, veterans, and visitors. They cover VA property all across the United States, conducting patrols, responding to calls, including calls about suicidal patients, and investigating crimes. Those four officers found evidence indicating that their supervisors covered up false reports, covered up for corrupt officers, unfairly promoted people in the force with whom they were having affairs, and performed numerous acts of favoritism. They had side businesses in violation of ethical codes, and they engaged in discrimination, gross mismanagement, and overtime pay fraud. When they reported their findings to senior officials, rather than those officials acting on the information, they targeted these four officers. Almost immediately, there were problems with their pay, they received poor performance evaluations, and they were transferred to desk duty while long-term investigations against them played out. As we say too frequently on this show, what happened was exactly the opposite of what was supposed to happen. We're joined today by one of those VA police officers, Tim Petoskey. Tim, thank you so much for being with us. We're glad to have you.
I'm honored to be here.
Tim, tell our viewers a little about yourself. How did you get involved in law enforcement, especially in federal law enforcement? And how did you end up at the Department of Veterans Affairs?
Sure. So I've been a cop for a very long time. I often joke that I'm not fit for anything else. I retired from a municipal organization. And then I started looking for something to do, sort of that dead space between retirement, where you're still young enough to get out and do the job, but you've passed your first milestone, you retired from your first department. And so I accidentally discovered that the Department of Veterans Affairs actually had police officers. I was surprised to find that out initially. And so in 2009, when I retired from the state side, I took a job with the VA for that reason. Originally, my thought was this was going to be a retirement gig. I couldn't envision that law enforcement at a hospital would be that detailed. And so I figured it would be a good place for me to kind of cool my heels until all of my retirements settled out. And I was still in the Army Reserve, so I figured, you know, this was a good place to come. So I've been working since the 80s. I worked street crimes in Florida in those years, and I've been a military intelligence officer for quite a few years, an MP in the Army and in the Air Force for a few years as well. So that's pretty much all I've done with my life. That's
wow.
Of the Boy Scouts.
Yeah, it is, right? You had been at the VA for a long time. You're a professional. You know the rules. And then you started seeing things that were just wrong. Tell us about that and about what you did when you saw these things.
Well, originally, like I said, I joined in 2009. By 2010, I kind of looked around and I was like, wait a minute, especially in what we call level 1A facilities, like out here in Seattle or Detroit or Boston, it is not just being a hospital cop. There's a lot of stuff that goes on in those facilities. And the agency here in Seattle was woefully understaffed. You had officers wearing hand-me-down second chance vests that were out of date, that radio systems didn't work, all kinds of stuff. And I almost just walked off the job. I almost just put my stuff in a bag and walked out the door. And a friend of mine named Rob Abbott was assaulted so bad that he'll never be a cop again.
Wow.
And he lay in a pool of his own blood screaming over those radio systems that couldn't work. and we couldn't find him. And so I looked, a friend of mine named Joe Murphy, a fellow officer, and in the days after Rob's assault, we just kind of looked each other in the eye and said, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And Joe said to me, am I my brother's keeper? Mm-hmm. And those words just hit me like a lightning bolt. And for, because Joe was a young guy, he was starting his career. I'm at the end of mine, right? Like my the ability for the VA to harm me is marginalized by the fact that my career is signed, sealed, and delivered in many respects. Joe was stepping up in an environment where the VA could ruin his ability to be a cop forever. And so it was an integrity check, you know. And so I had to step forward. And Joe and I did. We, especially in those initial years, it was just Joe and I against the world. Mm-hmm. And then he moved on to Federal Protective Services and went on with his career. And I stayed at the VA. You cited the story, the news story where the four of us went public, but I've gone public several times before that. And after that story was released, there was a hit list that was leaked by the VA. My name's on it, and they call me the ringleader. Wow. For VA police nationally.
Wow.
And I bear that like a badge of honor.
That's right.
I don't know how deserving that is, but I'm more than willing to own it. And so it's been a pretty long road, and this is my first interview.
Well, I'm thrilled by that. I'm thrilled by it. This is important. You made protected whistleblower complaints. There are laws that deal with this kind of thing. Were you working together with the other officers on these issues, or were you reporting independently of one another and then sort of came together later?
Yes, to both. So I worked my own issues. There were officers who were absolutely afraid for their careers to come forward. So they would send me the information. I would vet it and collect it, and then I would file the complaints for them. Some folks, Jeremy Balzan out of the Washington, D.C. VA, we kind of encountered each other because of the hit list. We were going through the hit list. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I don't know this guy. And he and I started talking, and they were actually doing all of the same things in D.C. that I was doing independently of me and unknown to me until the hit list came out. And mm-hmm. then we started coordinating. Of course, from that point forward. So yes to both.
So tell us what happened once you blew the whistle. You've said, or at least I've seen accounts in the press saying that you were given poor performance evaluations. You were put on desk duty while you were investigated, for example. Tell us about that and what else happened to you.
Sure. Well, the apex of that was in December. They fired me.
Oh, my God.
And you're going to love this part. So it was two-pronged. The first was that I was working a case in which a veteran had stated that he had contracted with someone to kill his wife. I was working that case with a municipal agency, the Federal Way Police Department, and I shared information with them under the exceptions to the law. And they fired me because they say that those exceptions to the law don't exist. That's their entire case. The second prong was they didn't like an email communication and a Facebook post that I made as a union steward on official time under the direction of the union.
Good grief.
And so the two aspects to the to December's termination are truly cartoonish. And that's something that kind of you have to highlight about the VA. You hear a lot of people talk about VA incompetence, and they do it with a kind of, you know, they're meaning to be insulting or to take a jab at the VA. The VA is truly incompetent at every level, and it's worth taking a moment to just think about that and understanding that they can't even abuse their authority in a competent manner. It's not like when I was a street cop or some of the other people you've had on the show who legitimately would get disappeared in a very precise and tactical manner. The VA can't do that. They'll try it, but they're going to mess it up, and they're going to leave a paper trail, and there's going to be an email or, you know, something of the kind, because we have, when I say we, I'm talking about the VA, have promoted these incompetent players to higher and higher levels, And then the echo chamber sort of seals that in, and you have this truly steeped. It's like the Stanford Prison Experiment, except right. It's just, you know, not as out of hand, maybe, or more out of hand in some respects.
One of the results of whistleblowing is the isolation and the loneliness that comes along with it. What was it like for you? You were forced onto desk duty. How did your friends and colleagues at the VA respond? Were they supportive? Did you have any other support from inside the organization?
Well, yeah. So again, this is sort of like my third life as a cop, right? So mm-hmm. I have a friendship network, and I got some really, really good advice all the way back in 1988. A senior deputy at the sheriff's department I worked for told me straight out, he said, "Tim, if you're going to do this job, get a hobby that doesn't have anything to do with law enforcement and get friends that aren't cops." And it was something I took to heart, and I've carried that through the years. So I kind of had this network established prior to that. But I'm pretty well known. And so when they transferred me out of police services and into the transportation division, there were a lot of people who found me on the sidewalk away from the VA where they couldn't be overheard, that offered their support, their gratitude. I'll get Facebook messages from time to time, just, you know, notes of encouragement. And they are absolutely critical. Jackie Garrick wrote this wonderful book about the psychological effects
yes.
of the retaliation and abuse of authorities. But every single whistleblower should immediately fall under that CA2, like without question. It's one of the changes in law that we need because of that psychological damage.
Yes.
I'm just fortunate enough that I planned for it.
Yeah, that was really very forward thinking. We're speaking with Department of Veterans Affairs whistleblower Tim Petoskey about problems inside the sprawling federal government. We're going to take a short break and come back with more of this conversation, which is stressful. Stay tuned.
Take a fresh look around at life. Kaleidoscopic, isn't it? A shattered reality distorted by power. Tired vision with no real opinions. Pictures designed to simplify or confuse. Who really wants a better world? And is it just for the chosen few? Fractured images presented as fact.
Can you see through their illusions? Going underground can.
In the year of 1954, the United States of America engaged in warfare against the people of Vietnam. The White House supported the corrupt puppet government of Southern Vietnam. In 1965, Americans began their invasion following the aim to defeat the forces of Vietnamese patriots. The Pentagon was confident that the victory would be on the American side due to its military superiority. However, the Vietnamese turned this war into total hell for the occupants. Unable to cope with the guerrillas, the American Army started blanket bombing alongside using chemical weapons and napalm, which burnt all alive. The village of My Lai, where in 1969 American soldiers killed 504 civilians, including 210 children, became a tragic symbol of this war. All in all, during the whole period of this conflict, the USA dropped on Vietnam more than 6 million tons of bombs, which is 2.5 times as much as on Germany during the Second World War. In 1973, the American Army, under the pressure of the rebels, withdrew from Vietnam, and only 2 years later did the puppet regime in Saigon fall. However, the Vietnamese paid a high price for their freedom. More than 1 million Vietnamese people became the victims of American aggressors.
Hi, I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'm here to plead with you, whatever you do, do not watch my new show. Seriously, why watch something that's so different? Why listen to opinions that you won't get anywhere else? Look, if it pleases you to have the State Department, the CIA, weapons makers, multi-billion dollar corporations choose your facts for you, go ahead. Why change? And whatever you do, don't watch my show. Stay mainstream, because I'm probably going to make you uncomfortable. My show is called Direct Impact. But again, you probably don't want to watch it, because it might just change the way you think.
Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with Tim Pitofsky, a whistleblower from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Tim, thanks again for being with us.
Always.
Tim, Frank Serpico, the famed whistleblower from the early 1970s New York Police Department, is a friend of mine. One of the things Frank has always been very clear about is that corruption only exists in police departments when police leaders allow it to exist. Frank also has been clear that he had very little support from other police officers when he made his revelations. You've said that other police officers in the VA are afraid, and when a whistleblower engages the VA's leadership, the VA attacks the officer. These attacks tend to be effective, and the majority of cops are afraid of losing their jobs and of being attacked in the same way as the whistleblower is attacked. I can tell you that this is also true in national security. The goal of those protecting the wrongdoers is to frighten would-be whistleblowers so that they remain silent. Tell us about what you went through immediately after you made your revelations. What was it like inside the VA?
Sure. Well, I think the worst was definitely at the very beginning when Joe Murphy and I made our original disclosures. They were using the WSDOT traffic cameras to follow us to and from work with the intent of harassing us about, you know, showing up on time or not, and anything that they could fabricate. They attempted to besmirch Joe's professional reputation when he applied for FPS in an attempt to abrogate his security clearance. Anything you can think of at some point in time, I went for an entire month without pay once because they couldn't get their pay worked out in my, I was the only one, by the way, right? But they couldn't pay me for an entire month. You said something in one of your other casts about integrity versus honesty, and integrity being something about self and honesty about, you know, something we project for others. Mm-hmm. I'd like to dovetail off of that and suggest that there's an institutional integrity, right? That the integrity of the individuals in those leadership positions bring, which is what I think Frank Serpico was getting, which by the way is one of my personal heroes. Mm-hmm. And this thing about intrinsic value and an agency's professional integrity and the intrinsic value that breeds for the agency or lack thereof. And that's exactly this situation with the VA, where they attacked me, they attacked Joe, they tried to project that abuse of authority in a grandiose manner with this sort of chest pounding look at what we can get away with, which is the audacity in my termination case. That is precisely what they are trying to transmit to the workforce, which is sit in the back of the bus and shut up, right? Mm-hmm. And we've seen that in the union. A number of our stewards have resigned. We are having all kinds of difficulties in getting that regular support. And we've got numerous cases at the Federal Labor Relations Authority that are focused back on the agency. I have personally won upwards, I think it's either 4 or 6 unfair labor practices from the FLRA since January of this year, because the agency has been so emboldened by my termination.
Wow. You know, there seems to be a theme here where you should be able to rely on your union to support you. And it's not just you, it's both inside and outside government. And there just really isn't much in the way of support from the union. One of your colleagues also told the media that revelations that the four of you made were not taken seriously and were not acted upon. Usually that's not the case. Usually they'll target you, try to get rid of you, and then quietly implement the changes that you demanded in the beginning. Why would VA officials engage in a cover-up when it would be so much easier just to work with you and make these changes?
Sure. Well, it gets back to that incompetence, right? It's so steeped, they don't know how to do that. But there's also layers, you know, like in the MI world back in the day. I know you've been around for a little while anyway, back in the map days, and you had the acetate and you used to do the layers, right? And you'd build up a picture, right? So one of those layers is this thing about some of the dangers within a hospital setting. Now, they're grandiose, but what I'm referencing here are actual serial killers that operate inside of medical facilities of all kinds. Now, there's a wonderful book by Bruce Sackman called Behind the Murder Curtain that focuses specifically on the VA's problem in this regard. And one of the things that he touches on in his book is that the serial killers that operate at the VA do so at VAs that are known to have poorly run police forces, poorly staffed police, et cetera. So this is, and there's been some Netflix videos and things like that. This is a horror story for hospital administrators. The last thing they want is for something like this to get out, and then they have to deal with the kind of panic that comes from it. But as you know, getting ahead of a story is how you deal with those critical elements. But the VA is so incompetent, they have nothing in their toolbox to deal with that complex reality. They can't even handle something like NCIC, right?
Yes.
Seattle was one of the only organizations in the state of Washington to have its terminals pulled because of the incompetent handling of the NCIC system, right? It's simple. It's walking the dog. If you've ever worked with these people, the FBI, the state of Washington, they're incredibly tractable. Mm-hmm. They tell you what they want, how they want it, when they want it. It's, you know, I love my brothers and sisters in the infantry, but even an infantry guy could get this done, right? But the VA can't. Right. And so how are they going to deal with these incredibly complex situations that you do have to deal with as a hospital administrator when your competency level is so low, you can't handle, you know, something like making sure there's enough paper for the fax machine.
One of the tactics that the VA used against you and against the other whistleblowers is through the use of your medical records. Your medical records were illegally accessed hundreds of times. I was shocked when I read that. In the case of one of your colleagues, he stopped a man for speeding on the grounds of a VA facility. That man happened to be a VA psychologist, and the psychologist threatened the officer over the speeding ticket. In the end, the officer's medical records were also illegally accessed 100 times, and he was unable to be promoted. Presumably, you have legal representation to try to guide you through this awful experience, but what do your lawyers say about this kind of illegal retaliation when a psychologist, because you're giving him a speeding ticket, can pull your medical records and leak them and use them against you? It's so patently illegal. How do you deal with that?
It's even worse than that, because that particular case that you're talking about, that psychologist was a clinical psychologist, not a forensic psychologist. We have assessments every year. They're done by forensic psychologists, not clinical psychologists. The clinical psychologist had to get sort of good old boy into the system to even look at that officer's case to begin with, let alone accessing his records and things like that. But one of the things that we've learned, or that I've learned definitely over my time with the VA, is that we are a cabinet level agency. And that's one of the things that kind of, it's brought me up short, I don't know how many times. And it's just taken me, quite a while sometimes to wrap my head around it, because we are on the same tier as the Department of Justice. You know, I looked a little bit at your story from the CIA, and it blew my hair back. But one of the things in listening to your story is that the VA thinks they are the CIA. They believe and they act with that kind of audacity, as if they can just make up something and who's going to make us do anything different. And to a large degree, they're right. We do not have to follow Department of Justice policy or direction. We're a cabinet-level agency, right? And so does the VA have to follow the law? That's something I pose to Congress all the time, because if you don't have an enforcement model, you don't have a law. If there's nothing there that says thou shalt or I will spank you, the VA is just going to do what it wants.
Right. Right. We used to say at the CIA all the time, it's better to act now and ask for forgiveness later.
So I may have said those words myself.
You mentioned earlier in the show that that you're no longer at the VA. I'm hoping that you still have a whistleblower case pending. So where does your case stand now? It seems like there have been no real changes, no interest from Capitol Hill, no satisfaction for the whistleblowers. What happens next for you?
So because I'm a union representative, the National VA Council sent me a lawyer, we are taking my cases to arbitration. Now, the reason why is because the Merit System Protection Board decides 97% of their cases for the agency. 97%.
Wow.
They were trying to justify that last session before Congress, and their logical reasoning, if you can call it that, is cartoonish as well. My cases are set for later this year, and the VA is going to have to stand in front of an arbiter and attempt to justify what their position is. However, their attorney is board certified. And so if the agency's case is going to continue to be that the law isn't the law, that's going to be a real interesting outcome for that particular lawyer. But the highlight that I want to make here is that if it were not for arbitration, I'd just be dead in the water, right? Because MSPB isn't going to help me. Right. They're going to decide for the agency. And this has happened to other VA police. Right. They've got to work their way through this system. You know, and I think you've experienced this yourself. There's a cost benefit analysis. Right. And if the agency can run that cost up at some point in time, those officers are going to walk away because it's too monetarily expensive. It's too emotionally expensive. It's too psychologically expensive. And the VA rests. That's how they've gotten away with this for so many decades.
Just crazy. Well, I would like to thank our guest, Tim Pitofsky, not just for being here with us today, but for allowing us to be his first interview. Thanks for that. And thanks to our viewers for joining us. Sometimes when a police officer is given maximum power, he bears minimum responsibility. That's why it's incumbent on the rest of us to support those brave officers who stand up in the face of waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality. They are the ones who keep the honest people honest. They are the ones who eventually will rout out corruption. They're the ones who are deserving of our support and our respect. I'm John Kiriakou. Thanks for watching The Whistleblowers. Until next time.